Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Glasses Manifesto.
Next thing you know, I was going back, heading back to New York with 44. And it, of course, was just a matter of time as I was getting more angry and frustrated with life, with the barking of the dogs and my social life and everything else, sexual tensions and frustrations building. But while I was getting angrier and angrier, my arsenal was building up. As I was walking around for somebody to harm or kill, I just walked up to this one car and just started shooting the gun. I just wanted to simply end their lives, that's all. I had so much anger that one attack against society wasn't going to quench it.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog to carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story, if not for anybody else, for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Hello, and welcome to Killer Tape. Killer Tape is a biographical podcast on the life and crimes of serial murderer David Berkowitz, also known as the Son of Sam, who murdered 6 and injured 10 in New York City between Christmas Eve, 1975, and July 31st, 1977. The story told within this podcast is largely told by David himself through an exclusive audio archive recorded in March of 1980 inside Attica Prison, where David was being held. There are many accounts of this story, and all of them provide a different, unique perspective on the overall picture. At times, we will be including information from each in order to flesh things out, as well as to provide context and commentary. But this story, at its core, is David's. The 19-hour audio interview around which this podcast is based was conducted by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones after he was contacted by Berkowitz and asked to come to the prison in his capacity as a reporter. The audio archive represents David's first in-depth interview with the reporter since he was sent to Attica Prison following his arrest on August 10th, 1977 for the murders of Donna Loria, Christine Freund, Virginia Voskarichian, Valentina Siriani, Alexander Esau, and Stacy Moskowitz, as well as the injury of Michelle Foreman, Jody Valenti, Rosemary Keenan, Carl De Niro, Donna DeMasi, Joanne Lomino, John Deal, Salvatore Lupo, Judy Placido, and Bobby Violante. As the story progresses and we reach a point in the timeline where one of David's vicious attacks occur, we will rewind a bit in order to include as much information as we can on the individuals directly targeted by the attacks, as it is our intention to keep the gravity of the lives affected by these horrendous crimes in context throughout the telling. These portions will be read by our series producer, Allison Baker. We will also include insights throughout the season from our co-host, veteran prison reporter Jack Jones, who conducted our interview with Berkowitz. But before we get into it and hear what David has to say, Jack and I are going to provide you with some information on New York City at the time, David's crimes and how they were reported, as well as a little bit about Jack and just how this whole thing came to be. As for the moral issues surrounding a story such as this one, it's hard to ignore the fact that we, as a society, stand in the footprint of great violence, and it is my opinion that only as the careful and unflinching witnesses of stories such as this one that we will ever have even a fighting chance of learning how we could potentially avoid events like these in the future. So with all that in mind, I welcome you to what I've come to regard as the dark side of democracy, where even the lowest among us have the right to tell their own story. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate that you're here. Now let's get started. Episode 1, Meeting Son of Sam. Act 1, A Time of Great Violence. The string of brutal and senseless attacks commonly attributed to the Son of Sam occurred in the boroughs of the Bronx, Queens, and Brooklyn in New York City between July 29, 1976 and July 31, 1977, a period of approximately 13 months. These are the attacks commonly attributed to the Son of Sam, but we now know there was at least one more attack 7 months earlier on Christmas Eve of 1975. We also know that the attacks were as strange and as senseless as the times.
It was over in a few seconds. Nasty way to put it, is there other way? I just had to do it, you know? The act was more important than anybody in suffering. In fact, I tried to, convincing myself that I had to do this, I tried to make it as easy as possible for the whoever might be the unfortunate victim.
It was the middle 70s, and New York City was in a state of rapid and desperate decline, a city down on its luck, to say the least. And at its absolutely worst moment, when the chips were most certainly down, someone was stalking the city streets in the middle of the night, shooting young women and men parked in cars along lovers' lanes.
In the Bronx, two people were killed, and that was my worst as far as the number of victims. I had killed two people at the time, a girl and a guy in a car. They were parked in his lover's lane, and they were making out. I snuck up on them and shot them.
The attacks appeared to be random, unconnected, and they appeared to be sexual. At least that's what was splashed onto the front page of the newspaper as the press sensationalized the coverage, played up the sex angle, and cast aspersions on the characters of the young women involved, driving hysteria, not to mention sales. But it certainly wasn't the whole story. It never is. In reality, the young women and men who were targeted were students, young professionals, beloved daughters and sons, aspiring young people lined up at the starting points of promising futures, gunned down before they ever had a chance to defend themselves or face their assailant. Often, it was all over before they even knew what was happening.
So no noise or anything, no traffic. It was on a little lovers, like a so-called lovers lane, you know. And the suddenness of everything would just leave anybody stunned. A loud blast, you know, I was only 3-4 feet from them, you know, would leave somebody stunned so that they couldn't react to any extent.
And to make matters worse, there seemed to be no tangible reason driving the attacks. The senselessness of the crimes only serving to make them altogether more terrifying.
One woman was killed. She wasn't sitting in a car, she was walking home, and I just shot her. I was prowling that neighborhood. I was there for about an hour, just walking around. And I saw her, and I just did it to
her. How close to the patrol?
About a foot away.
Attacks such as these were virtually unheard of, and at first, there was very little linking them together. In fact, there was only one thing linking them together: a small collection of .44 caliber slugs taken from the crime scenes. Once these slugs were taken to the crime lab and compared to each other, ballistics revealed that all of the .44 caliber slugs recovered contained markings indicating that they came from a single gun. This meant that the murders were linked, most likely the act of a single individual.
The next day I bought the .44. And now I had the pistol complete, the .44, you see. I needed a gun that I could conceal, because I guess already I was thinking, well, here we go, you know, this is it.
In a time before the term serial killer was commonly known, in a time when police, and certainly the average citizen, believed that crimes were committed out of a clear need or causality, I am hungry, so I steal, I am jealous, so I kill, and so on, This ballistics match let police and eventually the entire world know that there was a quote-unquote lone psycho out there, hunting the young on the streets of New York City for seemingly no reason.
Shot right through the window. Side. Passenger side. Behind the discotheque.
And so began the chaos and panic of the Son of Sam murders that would engulf New York City and drive it to the brink of destruction. Here's our co-host, veteran prison reporter Jack Jones.
From the end of the 60s right on, the middle 1970s were a period of a great deal of turbulence, from political assassinations causing riots in major cities across the country.
If it can be said that violence begets violence, then the middle 70s were proof positive. The decade before had been long and bloody, starting with the assassination of the U.S. President John Fitzgerald Kennedy in 1963. Followed by Malcolm X in 1965 and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968, the assassination of the latter, which led to widespread rioting across the continental U.S. And then, just 2 months later, Bobby Kennedy, brother to President Kennedy, was shot down at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, California. But before the decade had a chance to come to a close, Los Angeles, and indeed the world, would only see more bloodshed, when acid-crazed hippies, known as the Manson family, murdered a pregnant Sharon Tate in 1969. And if those assassinations and gruesome murders weren't enough, the entire decade had been blanketed by the atrocious violence and rising body count of the Vietnam War. This was the state of affairs heading into the 1970s.
The 70s were a spillover from all of the violence that had been triggered by the Vietnam War. Everything seemed unsettled. There was none of the stability that most of us had been taught as children. It was our birthright of peace and justice and equality. And the reality was becoming more apparent that those were all big lies. So everyone was feeling unsettled, unsure about the future, and not anchored to whatever ethics or codes we had been raised as children to accept.
It most certainly and most definitely was not the 1950s anymore. The 1960s had proven that, and now stood between the two decades, a vast, immovable sea, an undeniable marker between the times. There was no longer a blanket promise of peace and personal happiness blindly made to every American. And although access to that promise had never been purposefully made to all, it was now obvious to everyone that it was no longer available to anyone. Everything was in a state of flux, and nowhere in the country was more unstable than New York City.
How do you recall the neighborhood that you grew up in?
Wild.
Did you run with any gangs or anything?
Yep. Well, not the gangs that you picture today, where they whip people with chains and cut people. It was a gang, but not as violent. The only thing we did was we got into fist fights with other people.
The post-war dream was gone, the revolution was over, and New York City was about to fail to repay the principal on $1.6 billion in short-term notes that were due January 1st, 1976. The city's mayor, Abraham Beame, was more than just a little concerned, and he had every right to be. The following year, 1977, New York City would default on that loan, cementing its descent into economic despair. The city was officially in trouble, and it showed. In addition to the financial crisis, the infamous energy crisis of the 1970s was also in full swing, the effect of which was that the city, along with its 7,895,563 citizens, was primed and ready to explode. And then it did. At the height of the Son of Sam murders, New York City suffered what would become known as the historic blackout of 1977 that would result in riots and general chaos across the five boroughs. The New York Post reported that it took 6,000 cops to arrest a total of 3,481 people as a result of over 25 hours of widespread looting throughout the city. Damages were endless. The New York Daily News called it, quote, a billion-dollar blackout. And all this took place in the midst of an historic heat wave. New York City could not catch a break.
This is Broadway in the Bushwick section of Brooklyn the morning after the blackout. Looting and arson erupted here minutes after the lights went out, continued all night and well into the following day. Mobs roamed the streets, smashing windows, ripping out gates, carrying away groceries, clothes, furniture, appliances, whatever they could get their hands on, whatever they could carry away.
New York was a pretty bleak place. There was a lot of pollution. There was a smog laying across the river. New York was on a real decline, and there was pretty widespread crime.
New York City had never really been known as a safe place per se. But in the 1970s, crime had reached epic proportions. And now, of course, there was a killer on the loose.
Did you carry a gun with you when you were traveling back?
Well, yeah, but it stayed in the car, because sometimes after work I'd go right out to these neighborhoods. I'd get finished with work 12:30 at night on weekdays, and then I'd go to the neighborhoods.
As if they didn't have enough to be scared of, people were now terrified of being shot down mercilessly in the street, despite the fact that the chance of that happening was highly unlikely. According to police statistics available at the time, your chance of getting killed in New York City was approximately 600,000 to 1, and getting killed by a stranger was closer to 2 million to 1. But that wasn't the way it felt. Film, television, print, and radio were telling a far different and more profitable story. Print circulation, which had been down at the time the Son of Sam murders began, reached record numbers during the spree. The murders proved to be an absolute boon to the industry, and the press couldn't get enough of them. The effects on the city were palpable, to say the least, as the gunmen entered the lives of every New Yorker via the front page of the morning, evening, and nightly news.
Society should be concerned because their lives are in danger. 100,000 people fall victims to violent crime every year in the United States. Last year, about 18,000 some odd hundred people were murdered, you see. And if you were to take all these together, because you need a computer to sort this, you would be surprised at the number of seemingly random, motiveless, and senseless crimes of violence that occurred. So many murders were just like this. And most of those, in fact, go unsolved, because in New York City, 43% of the homicides never get solved. That's the average. And those crimes that never get solved are the ones that have no rational reason for them, you see.
Murders have always gone on, but the phenomenon of a lone individual intentionally seeking to terrorize a city of millions of people when some diseased mind began murdering innocent human beings, it was a pandemic of sorts. It resulted in virtual lockdowns of large parts of New York City.
The string of vicious attacks occurring in the city was outside of what anyone could conceive of at the time. And it caused a generation already on edge to continue to question everything.
I had a number of friends who dyed their hair from the dark color to blonde or red or something to try not to become a target, and who stopped going out because nobody knew where this guy was going to strike next. He struck terror into the hearts of young women all over New York City. It forced people to rethink, particularly young women, to rethink everything they did.
Many young brown-haired women in Queens are worried about their safety because of the .44 caliber killer. I interviewed one of them.
Yeah, you have to be careful. You have to watch where you go now.
And what was particularly heartbreaking about all of this was that it was happening just as young women across the nation were beginning to feel the liberating effects of the feminist movement, which had begun to make significant strides just a few years before, led by Gloria Steinem and others. And now, there was a new, and as of yet unnamed, scourge upon them, only to be added to the forces they were already fighting.
When you started going out with your crimes, you were looking specifically for women. Right.
Well, yeah, but I'd appreciate if you didn't mention it now because it won't sound right.
And to make matters worse, no one knew who or what was behind it, least of all the police. That is, until they caught a break.
After the police determined that all of the victims had been shot with a .44 caliber pistol, that's when they first began thinking this could be one person. And they were looking to try to determine a pattern. And the first element in that pattern was the .44 caliber slugs that they pulled out of bodies.
The killer was quickly dubbed the .44 caliber killer, and the police mobilized. The task force that had begun with approximately 12 officers grew into what would become known as the Omega Task Force, staffed with over 300 police officers and detectives, promising glory, promotion, and money to whoever broke the case. What followed proved to be an absolutely hysterical citywide search for the killer, with upwards of 5,000 people a day calling in tips, concerns, and quandaries related to the case.
Detectives of the Special Homicide Task Force added the new incident to the previous six shootings and began the painstaking search for similarities in the backgrounds of the victims. And they began checking out many tips from people in the community.
People called in boyfriends, landlords, husbands, virtually anyone that had ever offended them or looked at them sideways on the street. Certainly anyone odd or out of place made the list. Before it was all over, police claimed to have investigated 3,167 suspects in the hunt for the man who was terrorizing New York City. It was one lone murderer against an entire city, and at that exact moment, it appeared the murderer was winning.
The anger built up to such an explosive point that after like a shooting, it would subside for a period of time, a couple of months, you know. And it's all, of course, it's not always the same way. You know, people may just be once. You hear about people that do harm somebody one time or kill somebody one time, and that's it. That released all their pent-up anger, and now they're normal again. In a sense, I know this is very selfish, but in a sense, that's therapy.
At one point, the search became so desperate that Detective Felitico of the Omega Task Force famously appealed to an unnamed mafia boss for help in finding the gunman, and the mafioso agreed. Police and mafia united against the killer. That's how it was. The killer, dubbed the .44 caliber killer, owing to the slug that tied the homicides together, was apparently unhappy with the name, because in April of 1977, he decided to give himself a new one. And he did so by writing a letter to the police.
Oh, the letters. They weren't crazy letters, by the way. See, people look at them and say the man's deranged madman. But you see, they missed the whole point of the letters. The letters were actually to spur the police on, right? You see, to drive them harder, because they see that this is, like, more serious than it is, you know? It's like to push the police into knowing more to catch me. And people miss this. They just see the letters as a guy terrorizing. Yeah, well, I suppose I wanted to call attention to myself, you see, as a criminal, even though nobody knew it was me.
The letter was dark, cryptic, promised more murder, and included the name by which he would later become known. That name was the Son of Sam. A name as murky and undefined as everyone's understanding of what was happening. Mysterious and unknowable due to its lack of meaning, Son of Sam served to drive fear even farther into the hearts and minds of those that heard it. Everyone already knew that this was the work of a monster. But now that monster had a name. And that name was the Son of Sam.
When did you first take the name of Son of Sam?
Well, it just came to me, you know, because I've always had a wild imagination. And the idea of calling myself Son of Sam, I guess, just came to me. Maybe I read Son of Something in a book, but I'm not really cognizant of it. I don't really recall, you know. I just named it after Sam Carr, Because Sam Carr was causing me a lot of aggravation with his dog barking.
Before it became linked to a man, Son of Sam, in and of itself, a totally nonsensical term to most people. After it was linked to murders, it was newspaper headlines and sensationalist tabloids breaking news.
Now that the killer had a name as dark and mysterious as the crimes themselves, the mythology behind the murders grew beyond control, casting a shadow over the five boroughs pretty much unparalleled by any one man in the 352-year history of the city. That is, until August 10th, 1977, when an unassuming Jewish postal worker from the Bronx stepped out of the shadows.
Good evening. David Berkowitz, 24 years old, a postal worker, walked out of his Yonkers apartment last night, turned the ignition key in his car, and found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
His name was David Berkowitz, and he was 24 years old.
Police discovered in his car the .44 Bulldog revolver and a Thompson submachine gun.
The city was shocked. There was no way that this could be the face of the monster that had been terrorizing them. They were New Yorkers, after all, brazen and fearless. And here was a guy standing before them they wouldn't even give a second glance to on the street.
Nobody would ever suspect me because I don't seem the type.
Berkowitz was, and still is, you know, a pretty nondescript person. If anything, he has a more pleasant than an unpleasant face. There's nothing that looks particularly evil or demonic about him.
Berkowitz's appearance and demeanor only added to the public's confusion. Despite having little understanding of why someone would commit crimes like these, that had not stopped them from furnishing themselves with a fairly detailed imagining of what someone who did things like this would possibly look like. And that was the face of a hideous beast, not a pudgy postal worker named Dave, whose trademark was a cherubic grin.
He had a sort of a round face and this innocent look and curly dark hair and big eyes and the big smile that he always wore. I mean, from the first photographs when he was arrested and when he was being led into the police station, you would think he might be led someplace to be given an award of some kind.
Suffice it to say, coming face to face with the reality that David Berkowitz was in fact the Son of Sam twizzled the minds of the general population. After all, what did it mean if someone who looked like them, talked like them, and worked a job like them was capable of doing something like this? Did that mean that they were capable? The thought was more than most people could bear. And that silly grin, that would become Berkowitz's trademark.
He had the attention of millions of people, tens of millions probably, worldwide. He was being linked to historical figures like Jack the Ripper and other infamous characters, even Adolf Hitler. Other than outrage and a sense of relief that a serial killer had finally been caught, it was astonishment that somebody so ordinary could possibly be this monstrous creature who had held a city of 8 million people in the grip of fear through a series of pointless murders.
Then he started to talk, and I don't think anyone was quite prepared for what he had to say.
The story he told was that there was a family of demons that lived inside his walls and spoke through a hole in that wall and spoke in the voices of the dogs that were tied up and barking behind his neighbor's house. The voices of the demons saying, kill, 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 I need more blood.
The story varies in its many tellings following the rest. But the central idea is that a 6,000-year-old Satan-type character named Sam controls a systematic army of demons who travel the Northeast inciting violence and dictating orders through demon-infested dogs tied up in the backyards of local neighborhoods. One of these such dogs, a black lab named Harvey of all things, belonged to Berkowitz's neighbor, Sam Carr, and allegedly spoke to Berkowitz on a regular basis, instructing him to kill. Harvey, he said, was one of the central forces behind the murders. And that was really all he had to say. The story was out, and the press took off like a shot. It was love at first sight. This was what nearly every journalist the world over had been waiting for their entire lives. A talking dog, possessed by demons, had instructed a postal worker to hunt and kill young women.
You did finally blow the dog away, didn't you? I shot at it, but I wounded it. you know. And then I told my defense attorneys, you know, when they asked me why did you shoot the dog, I just said, well, the dog was telling me to kill or something, or the dog looked like an old woman. But this, of course, was silly.
Once a demonology and mythology is created around it by tabloid journalism, it's going to be like a daily soap opera that people can't escape, a tragic drama that went on for a couple of years.
And it was a cash cow, a virtual money faucet that generated circulation numbers never seen before. They couldn't make up a story like this if they had sat around their desk chewing on their pencils all day. But then they didn't have to. Berkowitz was doing it for them. It was lightning in a bottle, a one in a million story that could make a journalist's career.
This was real life Stephen King horror story come to life, not just in some rural little town out in Maine or someplace. This was in New York City, and it took place right under the noses of the biggest media and the biggest police forces in the country.
The mics were hot and the cameras were ready to pipe steaming hot piles of new information out to the world in ever-increasing quantities. And it wasn't a one-way relationship either. Audiences on a global level gobbled down everything they were given as if, in the words of Shakespeare, increase of appetite had grown by what it fed on.
The story of the demons kept getting more and more fantastic, I think, partially to try to feed the fires of publicity, which he clearly enjoyed at that time. And finally, he was being recognized as this phenomenon who had been used by these powerful supernatural forces to inflict murder on random human beings. He got more and more lurid the more he talked about it.
But speaking of that, what was the real story here? And who was the man behind the murders? And perhaps, more importantly, would that man be held accountable for his actions? As it would turn out, a young reporter from the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle was destined to find out. His name was Jack Jones, and he was already starting to develop some of his own opinions and worries about the Son of Sam.
My thoughts at that time were that this guy is truly crazy as hell. I mean, just unimaginably psychotic. Or he has an amazing imagination, which I thought was more likely, and that he might be able to actually pull off an insanity defense and somehow wind up in a mental hospital and then released after a few years to do the same thing, maybe.
Released in a few years? Sounds impossible, but Berkowitz certainly did seem crazy, and if he did pull off an insanity defense, it would be up to the doctors, not the penal system, as to when he would be released. And because of this, many people were worried. David Berkowitz had murdered their children, and they wanted to see him punished.
If Son of Sam is convicted, what do you think should happen to him?
What do you think? Dead. Period.
Punishment, as it turns out, was not far off. And on May 8th, 1978, David Berkowitz voluntarily pled guilty, was sentenced to 365 years in prison, and was sent upstate to Attica to serve out his sentence.
I don't have any appeals or anything, you know? Everybody knows I got a big sentence. 13 consecutive life sentences, it comes out to. And they say to me, well, how's your appeal coming? I say, what appeal? You ain't got a feeling, man? No. Why not? Got nothing to appeal.
When Berkowitz arrived at Attica Correctional Facility in June of 1978, Jack had already been working with murderers for years. Jack, like many Americans, had been alerted to the dismal conditions inside America's prisons when the Attica prison riot made headlines in September of 1971. State police, under the order of then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller, quelled a prisoner uprising by firing into the crowd, leaving 43 dead, prisoners and guards alike, resulting in the bloodiest day to ever occur between American citizens since the Civil War. When a second prisoner uprising was suspected a few years later, Jack's paper stationed him outside the prison to conduct a solid month of in-depth reporting. During that time, he got to know the guards and learned that there was an unusually high number of incarcerated veterans within the prison system. Being a veteran himself, this piqued Jack's interest. He wanted to know more, and he began conducting interviews with both guards and inmates. Jack's investigation into incarcerated veterans was the first of its kind in the nation and culminated in a string of articles that helped shed some light on mental health issues within the prison system. It also proved to be a trial by fire in conducting interviews with the truly violent.
At the time, I had encounters with people who had killed in Vietnam and in prison, which I covered for the newspaper at that time. I had been up close and personal with people who had killed a number of other people, and I saw them from my journalistic background as people in whom something went wrong.
Jack is a truly empathetic soul who cares deeply for people. And this empathy is not limited to the victims and their families. And so when David Berkowitz came along, he was intrigued. But he had no idea at the time if or when an interaction between he and Berkowitz could or would possibly happen. So he put it out of his mind. After all, Berkowitz was one of the most infamous murderers in the world, and every journalist on the planet was vying for a one-on-one interface with the killer, as well as whatever time in the spotlight that came along with. So to Jack, it was only a possibility that passed through his mind momentarily.
I guess I thought what a fascinating creature that might be to study, never realizing that someday he would write to me and ask me to interview him when he was imprisoned at Attica, about 50 miles from Rochester, New York, where I was working as a journalist and covering the prison system at that time.
It seems that Jack's articles on mental health issues within the prison system had found themselves a new fan, and one day, quite unexpectedly, Jack received a letter.
The first thing I did every day when I got to the newspaper office was to check the mail. When I see this letter from Attica Prison and the name above it, D. Berkowitz, and I thought, couldn't be the same guy. I opened it, and, I had a letter handwritten very neatly. Very good penmanship, and he asked me if I would come in and meet with him. I walked over to the city desk where my assignment editor was, and I showed him the letter. I think his very words were, "Holy shit."
Holy shit indeed. Truth is sometimes truly stranger than fiction. And it wasn't just that Berkowitz had read Jack's articles and sought him out for the interview. It was the fact that after Berkowitz's arrest, he had shied away from the media altogether and had not had any significant involvement with them for over 2 years.
He never really spoke one-on-one with any media person until my interviews with him. After his arrest, he was secluded from other prisoners, and the only contact he had was with police investigators and the psychiatrists that were examining him for fitness to stand trial. So, they authorized me to set up the meeting as soon as possible.
It was the in-depth interview that every journalist wanted and no one had received, and it literally landed on Jack's doorstep in a neat little package.
I'll work with you because, you seem like a decent guy, but, you take some of the reporters from pages who want to sell the stories and sensationalize. They're not really interested in letting people understand anything. They just want to put all the sordid details in together.
But as with most things dealing with murder and murderers, the offer was not completely transparent. There was, of course, an angle. Berkowitz had an agenda, and he needed someone on the outside to carry it out for him.
He wanted me to emphasize his good work for a crime victims compensation effort for the survivors and victims of the 1971 Attica prison riot, as well as the victims and families of his own crimes in New York City.
The Victim Crime Compensation Board of the state of New York did not start or end with David Berkowitz, but its backing of what would become known as the Son of Sam Law generated a lot of press and became a highly visible act of the organization. The Son of Sam Law was and is a great thing. It is a law that bars criminals from benefiting financially from their crimes. But clearly, there were ulterior motives at work here in terms of Berkowitz's involvement, to say the very least.
Even though he did horribly evil things, he was always looking for some way to be a hero. He was looking for one act, something to do to redeem himself and give himself social value. And barring that, he looked for attention any way he could get it.
Redemption being a long ways off, attention was still on the table. And the attention he had gained for the initial murders and the Son of Sam demon mythology that followed was beginning to wear off. Berkowitz needed a new angle to get back in the press, and with it, a new look. He had already played the villain. Now it was time to play the hero.
I'd have much rather been a hero than a villain, doing something spectacular every other week, you know, rescuing people or something.
He got a lot of attention when he gave himself the identity of the Son of Sam. And by latching on to the Son of Sam law, which was written against him, he thought he could bring greater public awareness and do more good for people who had suffered because of not only his own crimes, but other injustices.
It was a mixed bag for sure, as most bags are, and Jack decided, perhaps not surprisingly, to take Berkowitz up on his offer, and the pair began to make arrangements to set up the interview. But for Berkowitz, it couldn't be soon enough.
I wrote him immediately saying, yes, begin the paperwork at your end, and I have authorization to come and meet with you. And he wrote back somewhat disappointed that it would take at least 2 weeks. He wanted to sit right down.
Dear Jack, I just got your letter today and I'm somewhat disappointed that it will be a week or more before I see you. At least this is what your letter seems to indicate. The sooner the better. Jack, all I ask is that you be honest and open with me. I need someone who will be impartial, but reasonable and helpful. Sincerely, David Berkowitz. So there you have it. Berkowitz felt as though he might have found his man on the outside. And despite his initial disappointment with the processing time of the in-person visitor application, it wasn't much longer before Jack was once again standing outside the gates of Attica Prison, waiting to be let into the ominous structure.
So a guard led me down the hallway to a room where I had sat for interviews with prisoners and part of a murderer's group that I went in and counseled with from time to time. Guard said, wait here, and he came back a few minutes later, and Berkowitz is walking beside him. No shackles, no handcuffs, no anything. Right into the room, he walked over and big old handshake. Hi, how you doing? I'm so glad to meet you. It was his apparent innocence and eagerness to meet me and talk. It was disarming. I'd expected somebody who would be at least guarded and probably paranoid, but he was just open. It's like you walk into a bar and you see somebody who's just looking for somebody to talk to.
And so, sans shackles or any bonds of any kind, sometimes with a guard present and sometimes not, Jack and Berkowitz sat and talked, each man having a very different goal in mind. Jack seeking insight into the inner workings of a violent mind, and Berkowitz seeking redemption in the eyes of the public.
I hope you don't go into all those details, because while it makes interesting reading, it's not going to... Yeah, well, what is his message going to be, mainly? I mean,
trying to fathom the motives of random killers.
All right, and I hope that's what it is instead of my crimes. You know,
but you understand, too, that we're going to have... Your crimes are already pretty well done.
Yeah.
Very well documented. Some of these details that other people don't know.
Well, okay, but as long as we clarify, because when you start to talk about the crimes of this, people start drifting off into the idea that the guy's a deranged man.
There was, however, one thing they did agree on, and that was that the series of interviews would culminate in a bare-all biographical telling of a story never fully told before, to first appear as a series of articles and then later as a book.
This was an effort to do what I thought my job as a journalist was, to alert the public to information that might make all of our lives better and at least save lives wherever possible.
So with this in mind, and the divergent intentions of the two men established, the conversation that would culminate in 19 hours of audio recorded within the walls of Attica Prison began.
The interview began, and I said something like, well, you asked me to come and talk with you, so let's talk about what you want to talk about. And he mainly, at that time, wanted to talk about his efforts on behalf of crime victims. And I said, that's fine, but if we're going to have a meaningful interview or a subject relationship, I need to also talk to you about your crimes. I wanted to know about his earliest childhood memories, his military experience, and focus on things that he might have discovered within himself since committing these crimes that might actually illuminate the reasons, tease out things in his life that motivated him to become a spontaneous murderer who carefully planned and carried out the murders of innocent people.
In the end, Jack got more than he bargained for.
I say, you know, let me try to do as much as I can, whatever time I have left. Because if anyone doesn't know how short life is, it ought to be me. You know, if anyone knows how short life is, it ought to be me. Because I had taken lives of six young people, suddenly, unexpectedly.
Next time on Killer Tape.
When I was about six or seven, my mother and father sat me down and told me that I was adopted. And they trying to mean well, right? They said that my mother died while giving birth, and that my father, terribly grief-stricken, had to put me up for adoption. And after that, I became extremely self-destructive, because I thought that I had killed my mother, you see. I used to cry out to God, why don't you kill me, you know? I'm the one who's supposed to die, because I was like an unhappy child, you know, I was just rebellious and vicious, you know. I think it all stemmed from this, you see.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistance by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D. and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt and Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.